In the Movie Podcast. Hello and welcome to In The Move For Podcast with Callum Reid of Ultimately.com and Pete Shepherd of InTheMoveForBlog.blog.co.uk. It's episode 39.
Ooh.
Hello.
Hi. Late 30s. That's officially not young anymore.
Yeah, neither of us are there yet though, so.
No. This time. Yeah, still ill. Had a week of it, full week of it, and hilariously, my cough is now even worse. Than it was last week. Well, it doesn't bother me, but I just cough all the time. It's like a dry cough.
Yeah.
Whereas like last week I was like bent over like hags every time I was coughing.
Yeah, I had to cut like one horrendous one out. Well, I was cutting out anyway because it was an outbreak, but it sounded awful.
Because it's literally every time I move like 8 feet, I'd start coughing.
Oh God.
But with this, I feel great, but I'm just coughing all the time. So it's gonna be a job for Cal. Again, violins.
And I'm hungover, so
yeah,
neither of us are on top form.
Yeah, expect a rapier-like podcast.
All right, do we have any news from the past week?
Yeah, quite a lot going on. Mila Kunis is a current Twitter superstar because the lad off of Radio 1 had a legendary interview with her. Have you seen this?
No.
It's absolutely brilliant. He basically didn't ask her any questions about the film and just was so nervous because he'd never done it before. Ended up inviting her down to watch Watford and go to Nando's before. And after about 5 minutes of them just chatting about boshing pints and having Jaeger bombs, she does like her publicist like says you've got to say something. So she rattles off this like minute long soliloquy, and his reaction to this is, yeah, so my mate Dicko is getting married in the summer. Do you want to come? So it was my plus one. It's so great. Yeah, Broadchurch started last night on ITV.
How was it?
It's kind of like Depression Fest, give everyone a scene. But Olivia Colman, David Tennant, Jodie Whittaker's the mum whose kids died. And it could be alarmingly trite. I've made a decision that if this turns into a serial killer thing where the guy is taunting the police, I will stop watching because I've just seen that far too many times before. But
it does sound pretty run of the mill, to be honest.
Yeah, it's well acted at the moment, but they are just like there are certain scenes where you just think, they're just trying to give someone a scene to cry. Giggsy's 1,000th game tonight for Man United. Well, yeah, the world is watching. Biggest news of the week is obviously Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist director Peter Sollett retweeting me.
Yes, which happened the other week, right?
Yeah, I forgot to mention it. How did I not mention that last week? Yeah, I did a tweet about using the soundtrack in my piano lessons for 6-year-olds, and he took the bait. And also, it's Pasolini's birthday today, or would be Pasolini's birthday today, which leads us into a potential new feature, which we've been kind of talking about for a while. Offline.
We've decided to be more positive.
And less modern because it's destroying my viewing habits, this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, we have a Nicholas Sparks film this week. I mean, come on. We need to celebrate the past.
Yeah. So we haven't got a name for it or anything yet. Something to do with retro or past or from the vault. Oh, the concept is it's a from the vault type thing where we take an old... but that's far too WWF classics. Where we take an old film and just have a look at it. Hopefully one we haven't seen, but one we were thinking of was Pasolini's Passion According to St. Matthew, which I have seen, but I haven't seen for a very long time, and Cal hasn't and wants to. So we might start off with that one.
And it's being re-released. Is it this week, I think?
Is it?
I think so.
Well, any excuse. Because, yes, and that's about it.
Well, I wanted to announce the forfeit as well.
Oh, yes, you decided. Well, I gave many options.
Yeah, we decided on that you have to watch The Rose, the Janis Joplin based biopic starring Bette Midler, which I love. So, well, I don't love the film, but I love her, so we'll see.
It was given from like a Streisand funny girl. I haven't seen that. I consider being forced to watch it. type situation.
Yeah. It's not subtle, so...
I also did get... What was the other one I found? It was like this Hugh Dancy in something that sounded just like Playing for Keeps. It sounded absolutely terrible, which I only came across because Meryl Streep's daughter was in it.
Did you see Evening? Because I've never seen that.
Yes, it's horrendous. Yeah. But his hat is super in that film. His hat is one of like the three non-atrocious things about it.
Silver linings.
Yes.
Yeah. So are you going to watch that in the next week or...
Yeah, I can do, yeah.
It's quite long, actually.
Provided it's online. I'm not going to go out of my way.
I think it is. Okay. So we're going to do Red Light District.
Yeah, which we haven't done for a while.
Yeah.
We're bringing it back.
Yeah, we're going to try to do it like once a month and just basically pimp the really great films we've seen in the past month.
Or quite decent films, depending on what a slate they've been.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, how many have you got this week?
Well, I've got three, but
I've got three as well.
Okay, cool.
That'll do, that'll work.
Yeah.
Right, you first then.
All right, well, I'm going to start with the best one, which I watched a couple of weeks ago. It's The Company, directed by Robert Altman.
Oh, yeah.
It's from 2003, and it just seemed to get dumped in 2003.
This is the ballet one with Neve Campbell.
Yes, and she came up with the entire idea. And I think she's a co-producer on it, because she lost money when it bombed.
Oh, poor girl.
Yeah.
Hence the Scream sequels.
Yeah, and she had to pay the actual actors herself.
Oh, God.
So, because it came out on Christmas Day. I mean, who wants to go and see a kind of realist ballet film on Christmas Day?
Unless you've got Mila Kunis and Natalie Portman. Doing some Cooney
Slingers. That wasn't Christmas, though, was it? It was beginning of December, I think.
So probably around.
But anyway, the film's really good. It's got Malcolm McDowell, who's awesome. He's like the director of the entire production. And he's just really catty and kind of... He's got these great monologues. And it feels very, like, improvisational.
Yeah.
It's just a different... It's way better than Black Swan.
Right,
It's just a different kind of... beast. Shouldn't be hard.
Black Swan's weird. I know a couple of people who just normal film fans. I mean, go to cinema a bit more than average.
Yeah.
Who both of their reactions to Black Swan was just, yeah, I get it, and so it was just too much. It's not as if this is like some incredibly complex idea. It's like. I've read Kafka. Thank you very much.
I guess people respond to the filmmaking in Black Swan because it's not like I thought it was going to get slated by a lot of people.
Oh yeah.
But people kind of, I think they just grasped onto how well made it was generally. Mm. But
I mean, I think it's all right. Don't get me wrong, but
yeah. Okay.
I'll start with, again, well, not necessarily the best, but the one with the best thing in it. If you do go on our podcast blog, you will see our updated top tens and nominations, and you will see in there, for me, Juliette Binoche in Another Woman's Life, which is Sylvie Testud's directorial debut, which came out last year in France. And she's just really, really good in it. I'm more surprised that she was good in it, because it's a very commercial film. It's about a woman who goes to bed with a man and then wakes up, and it's like 50. She's been married to him for 15 years. She's on the brink of divorce and she can't remember a thing. For her, she's just woken up the next day.
Yeah.
And it's one of these performances where she just encapsulates these crystallized moments so perfectly of like looking in the mirror and seeing that you're 15 years older or what have you, or looking on and finding out that you've got a son, or that you're not the person that you wanted to be, and all these sort of things. And so it's not the most demanding of plots, and it's hardly the greatest film in the world, but she just injects so much into it. It's kind of like a 13 going on 30 slash big type thing, where she's just gone on, because she's the same person, but she's just a lot older, and she's thrust in situations that she's not... familiar with, but it's not a comedy. It's done more for dramatic effect. Gorgeous little score. So Testud's got an eye for putting everything together.
Yeah.
And but it's just not that convincing, and some of it's a little bit trite. But it is quite good because of just sheer force of will from Binoche.
Okay.
Hmm.
The second great one I saw was Vanya on 42nd Street.
Yes.
Which is the other
Brooke
night.
Smith people. This is just my immediate reaction whenever I hear that. Brooke Smith people.
Yeah, even though you prefer Julianne.
I do just. But it's because the two scenes I remember the most about that film are Brooke Smith. And it's the Why Am I So Plain speech. And then the end.
Yeah. It's the best character. I mean.
Yeah.
But I think this is like... It's a dress rehearsal of...
It's a non-dress rehearsal.
A non-dress rehearsal, yeah.
Yes.
Of Uncle Vanya, which is a Chekhov player.
Yeah.
On Broadway.
Yeah, and it doesn't make any sense in that respect, because they're acting it cinematically. And they're doing everything cinematically. So it's not as if this is like a Olivier Othello. This is what it would be like if you were watching it on stage. No.
No. So,
but the conceit around the setup is very clever. It's that it's a load of people, actors just come off the street and they're doing their one of their final rehearsals before they do the dress rehearsal.
But they are like there's certain laughs at times, and I kind of thought, is that supposed to be there, or is that just part of what they're doing?
Yeah.
And I think it does help that it is like a performance of it, because it feels like the actors are kind of learning the roles as they go along, and that kind of gives you a window into the play a lot more. And I think it's really interesting. I wish they'd have played around with that a bit more, like had more breaks where they kind of mingle together casually, normally. But it's really good. I mean, we want to see other kind of adaptations of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the trouble with Chekhov adaptation, I mean, maybe I'd like to see another adaptation of that, see how it stacks up. I think in general, Chekhov adaptations aren't that good, but Rampling's very good in The Cherry Orchard, the Michalis Kakoyanis film from the late 90s. I'm not a fan of the Sidney Lumet Seagull with Vanessa Redgrave.
I've not seen that.
It's very difficult to get hold of. I think I had to actually download that one. It's really, really obscure. And with reason.
There's the Three Sisters is the other big one, right?
I watched the beginning of that, but it was just too long and I wasn't in the mood for it.
Yeah.
I've got a couple more. I picked up a Deneuve film on DVD when I was in Berlin. It's not available here because Deneuve films from the late 70s, early 80s just aren't available here. And it's called Us Two, or A Nous Deux. It's a Lelouch film. Very, very... It's sort of like a... Kind of turns into a Bonnie and Clyde-ish type thing, but basically it's that they're both... She's like a prostitute, obviously, typecast again. And he's a robber who's got out of prison, he's gone on the run. And so they're both hiding out at the same safe house, and then the safe house gets rumbled by the police, and then they're forced to go on the run together. And it's kind of not half as exploitative as these sort of films, particularly for the French, usually are. And it's just very stylish. And she has a couple of scenes that she's really does come to play in. But for the most part, it's just about letting the story do the work. So that was a nice surprise. And just can't get it here, so.
Yeah, good. Though my last one is a film that you also love, which is The Cranes Are Flying.
Oh,
I watched a couple of weeks ago. It might have been last week.
It's a cinematography fest.
It is. It's a beautiful film. Very strange film. It's not done. It's not finessed, I wouldn't say. It's sort of more just kind of hell for leather with the cinematography.
Yeah, it's a force of nature.
Yeah.
And it has set pieces that still stand up today within it. Like the piano scene with the stuff going off in the back. Is it the bombs or is it a storm? I guess I think it's bombs.
Yeah,
with the piano. It might be a storm. Anyway, the railings with the child with the super. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And she's excellent in it, Tatiana Samuilova.
She is. She's very good. wary at first. It's a bit of a Scarlett O'Hara kind of performance, really. Kind of, she realizes too late that she's done the wrong thing. But
you can see why she got put as Anna Karenina.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really eager to see that. But I guess it's nowhere, right?
I saw it dubbed by Americans like 5 years ago.
You really don't want that.
But even so, I still gave it like 8 out of 10. So if I ever saw it properly, I might attempt to give it more. Lastly, Rent-A-Cat, which is a Japanese film from last year. Very cute little indie. Which is about a woman who can only attract cats rather than men. So she has a rent-a-cat business where she goes around the goes down the river and trying to rent cats to people who look lonely. And the comedy comes from the same scenes being done pretty much over and over again. So when she tries to rent them, so she's got like this. She's like, let me get the contract out, and it's like a piece of paper with 3 different things on it that you've got to write in. They always, when they try and pay her, they say, how much is it? And she'll put like a number 1 up, and they'll say, 10,000 yen. She's like, oh, no, like 100,000. Like, no, 1,000. Which is like 7 quid. And you're renting a cat to this old woman until she dies, and you're charging her 7 quid for it. So they all ask her, the conversation happens identically. It's like, well, how will you survive? Well, do I look as if I'm not surviving? Well, frankly, no. And then every time she comes up with a different story for what she does to actually make her money, so be it like a stock, a whiz on with stocks or things like that.
Well, if she's got all these cats, though, isn't she going to be... She's not going to get a man, is she?
No, that's the point. She's writing these things like, must find husband by end of year. Like, in beautiful calligraphy and putting it up on the wall.
And of course she finds one.
Well, no, this guy just, like, walks into her life, who used to know her at school. He's very, like, segmented. It goes from one to the next, one to the next. It's more about the renting of the cats than anything else. But, yeah, it's a very nice, charming performance. It's a very quirky film. I think, I'm not sure you'd be in love with it, because it's that sort of the fairy type, very twee tone.
Yeah.
And with the repetitiveness, that if you're not on board with the tone, that could get grating quite quick.
But, is this Korean or...?
Japanese.
Japanese, okay. Mm. All right, so we've given people a lot to... digest there.
Yeah.
On the positive side. So if you want to check out any of these titles, they are either available online or on DVD.
Yep.
Otherwise we wouldn't have seen them.
Yes.
Okay, so should we get on to preconceptions about this week?
Yeah. This week we're doing Stoker, Arbitrage, Broken City, Safe Haven, and To the Wonder.
Yes. Then preconceptions about Stoker.
Yeah, well, Park Chan-wook, if you asked me in 2007 or 2006, I would have said he was one of the best directors in the world.
Right.
With the Vengeance Trilogy and JSA, Joint Security Area, which I think is a really good film. It's got the woman from Lady Vengeance in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting film set on the station on the South North Korean border, hence Joint Security Area. And so that's a super film. People really should see that. And so that's my preconception for Park Chan-wook is always, yeah, he used to be great, but his last two films I haven't been able to watch over half of. I've just stopped watching because they've been that awful.
Well, I really liked Thirst, but this Stoker looked more along those lines than his old stuff. So were you a bit worried about that?
I went in with goodwill, actually. I remember we talked about our most anticipated ones.
Yeah,
I was just thinking, well, maybe it's more of a return to the sort of more action-y type genre,
less silly.
Yes, yeah, yes, exactly, yeah. Because I'm a Cyborg is just completely off the walls.
But the cast is really good for this.
Yeah, love Mia Wasikowska. Good's fine. I really like him in Brighthead Revisited, actually.
He looked like he'd fit very well in that. I didn't know he's in that, but yeah, he looks like he's in Brideshead Revisited in this film. But
yeah, yes.
But yeah, I was quite looking forward to this, actually.
Mm. Yeah, me too. Arbitrage looks just... No. It just didn't look interesting, quite frankly. I don't mind Richard Gere, but I don't like him actively at all. And that's pretty much all I knew, that it was Richard Gere, and that was it. So
it looked a little dull and kind of like Marge and Cole. I mean,
yeah, but yeah, that's sort of it's that sort of topic I was expecting.
Yeah,
in terms of preconception, yeah, Broken City looked pretty lame.
It did look lame. I didn't see this
from the trailer, and so I saw this rather than Hansel and Gretel. It was a one or the other type one, and I thought, well, okay, well, this is the more serious film. Wahlberg, he's serviceable. I'm not a big fan of him, but I don't dislike him, despite his best efforts. Crow, I just end up watching all of his films. I just can't avoid it. And Zeta Jones, she's fine. So nobody's like really wow for me in the cast.
Yeah.
Safe Haven.
Safe Haven. Lasse Hallström, who I've not seen Life as a Dog, but. Yeah. It seems as if every single thing he's done after that has never been able to get to that level as Life as a Dog in people's estimations.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Well, I quite like The Shipping News. I'll get that out there.
Okay.
And I don't mind Chocolat at all. Mm. But, it's the Nicholas Sparks thing that just made me not watch this.
Yeah. I've not seen The Notebook either.
I have. And I don't dislike The Notebook. It's a decent film. But yeah, without McAdams and Gosling, and without that cast, and this probably isn't going to be as good a story. So that's why I didn't watch it.
This is Julianne Hough and Josh Duhamel.
Yes,
so not exactly vintage casting. So no. I wasn't expecting a masterpiece, but I thought I might get entertained at least.
And lastly, To the Wonder, I ended up getting really excited for it. By the end, because I just remembered that I do really love Terrence Malick, and it's only that I didn't like the Tree of Life. It's like a one-off.
And you wanted to love him again.
I did, and I like Olga, so I was hopeful, and I liked the trailer.
Yeah, I've really liked Terrence Malick's films, apart from Badlands, which I was put off by, but no, it's a decent cast, although you never know who's going to make it and who isn't.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll start with Stalker. I'll do a plot for this.
Yes, please.
Stalker is about Richard Stalker, who has died at the beginning of the film. His wife is played by Nicole Kidman. His daughter is played by Mia Wasikowska. His brother comes to stay with them. He's been travelling around the world and around Europe, but he isn't all that he seems, and he becomes quite dangerous for the family. And Mia Wasikowska is not...
Yeah, she's not the most social of beasts.
Yeah, she's not the most social of beasts. She's kind of like a Carrie-type character.
Mm.
And she becomes quite impressionable, and she has a sort of weird supernatural ability to sense things before they happen, or so we're told.
Yes. Natural comparison piece to this for me, or compare and contrast piece to this for me, is I Wish, which we did the other week. Because I Wish was really decent. Well, it was okay for like about an hour and a half, and then was really, really good at the end.
Yeah.
Whereas this is decent for about an hour and then really, really awful at the end.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm.
It's fine. Like,
the setup's okay.
Yeah, but then once I look back on it, I think that the first hour does have a lot of things borrowed from other films. Like, the whole thing with Jackie Weaver is actually probably the best part of the film. But it's... feels borrowed from a lot of other stuff to me, like.
Yeah, well, the setup of it's hardly original relative coming out of the blue.
Yeah.
imposing themselves on the family. It's nothing. There's nothing new there, but it sort of relies on the sort of like eerie, weird tone.
And it's, in order to, it's got this preconception with like psychology as well, and kind of Freudian elements to it. But it seems to completely contradict everything in the last act. Like,
well, what it is that it's the shower scene that, which is just so completely misguided and ill-conceived. And then from there, it's just a complete train wreck, and they just push it in the most lurid, pathetically so, directions.
Yeah.
And it's just...
It's fairly obvious as well. It's, yeah. It reminds me of Birth. Like,
yeah.
You know, it tells you at the beginning basically what's happened, and you, yeah. You can sense it anywhere. So it's putting its focus on Mia Wasikowska's character and kind of forging its interest through her, like why she acts the way she does towards the uncle character, and her learning to kind of understand him. Mm. But the way that it starts the film, it kind of says that the daughter has had a really great relationship with the father.
Yeah.
And so I don't really buy what eventually happens.
No, it is. It's extraordinarily unconvincing. And Matthew Good ends up being really quite terrible in the last 40 minutes or so.
I thought he was great.
That really doesn't help. No, I thought, oh, he's the worst thing about it for me. I thought Wasikowska and Kidman tried. But no.
Kidman's great in the one scene.
The Who Are You scene.
Yeah. And Wasikowska's fine. Just usual, really.
But... yeah, that scene from the beginning, which then obviously bookends back at the end, that's the only real scene where the character, where she injects life into it and suggests possibilities that aren't necessarily just completely self-evident. And you just wish there'd been more of that along the way.
Yeah. What do you think about Park? Because it's really quite beautiful film. The cinematography is just awesome, as you'd expect. But like, it's reminded me of like martial arts films, like Chinese, with the blood splattering, like kind of paint on a canvas.
I think it's just I think it's just really exploitative of just, he's just trying to amp it up and just go for as much as he can. And I'm just bored of it by this point. It's just not interesting to me because I've seen him do it over 10 years ago. If you're really not matured as a filmmaker at all. I just despair, really. That is the only word to describe it. It's uninteresting. It's I just shake my head.
Yeah. It's just a shame because the first hour is really good at building tension and kind of creating interest, and then it just
it's the screen. It's not necessarily Park's fault. It's the screenplay.
Screenplay.
It necessarily goes in the most awful directions, and
this is Wentworth Miller who wrote this, who was in Prison Break.
Oh, is that why I shouldn't know who he is?
Yeah.
No. Some of the cinematography, especially with like the, just thinking back on the cinematography, like the, with like the bonfires, what have you, it is well shot. And I'm not just saying this is a complete, I mean, I do think it's a bad film, but I'm not saying it's completely awful, because it's fine for an hour. I mean, but it's like we were saying with I Wish, how much does that bad 40 minutes bring down the decent hour?
Yeah. It's a bit like when we watched Red Lights.
Yeah.
Although that was kind of fell off the cliff a bit later. But
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's just a shame. I just think they could have done so much more with this. And it's all in the writing to me. I think it's cast well. I think it's directed pretty well for the most part, but it just falls off the cliff.
Yeah, what's your grade on this then?
C-.
Yeah, low 2 stars for me.
Okay. Oh, God, really?
Yeah. Because it was 3 stars up until it was like 5 or 6 out of 10.
Okay. Shame. So, on to Arbitrage.
Yeah. Yeah, so Arbitrage is the new Richard Gere film, and yeah, it's a Richard Gere film. In case you didn't know. Yeah, he's playing a millionaire. Typecast again. 8 minutes in, he's ditching a family party to shack up with his mistress. 8 minutes in. Typecast again. And then after a couple of reels, there is an incident involved, which involves in an unexpected death. Is this just like a collage of Richard Gere films previous? And so then it's sort of the setup is so the point of it is you've got this sort of like half baked Crime and Punishment Dostoevsky thing going on with Tim Roth. Tim Roth playing the cop who's investigating the situation, and so that's on the one hand, and on the other hand, Gere is attempting to defraud a bloke out of hundreds of millions of dollars by pretending he's cooked the books basically, and he's trying to sell his company.
Yeah,
and it's kind of impossible to care about any of it because it doesn't push the moral. It doesn't go the full Dostoevsky way on it and show like the moral decline.
Well, are you supposed to feel sorry for Richard Gere because?
No, I don't think you are. Based on this film, because I think you're supposed to want him to get away with everything. But then again, why would you? This is the I don't understand. It's the Joe Wright rant of the week. I just don't understand where the investment is supposed to be in this film. At all, because you can't, because he's a smug billionaire who cheats on his wife and has his cake and eats it, and then is committing multiple crimes, and you can't want him to get away with it.
No. So,
but then, if you're not actually going to show him change, what is the point in him maybe getting caught?
Gere does a decent job of making him seem like he's acting in. How he believes is the right way to go about things, or how he's been going about things for so long that he can't see what's wrong with his behaviour. But
yeah, and the screenplay does a decent job of setting up the premise that he deals solely in buying and selling.
Yeah,
even with his relationships with people.
Is it? I'm not sure I understood it, but is it something to do with he's inflating the cost of the company so the stock's higher, so it's all based around fake money?
Yeah, well, what's happened is the company is worth a certain amount. Nobody else knows that there is actually this massive hole in the books.
Yeah.
So what he's done is he's got a company which is worth X amount of money, but in reality it's worth it's got this $400 million deficit. So he's illegally borrowed the money off a mate of his to plug it in there, so that when he sells the company and they do the checking, they can say, okay, yes, the money's there. And then so of course, as soon as they've got that confirmation, he's going to take the money out, give it back to his mate, and then he's going to screw the people who are buying the company.
Yeah.
So he's a moral bankrupt basically, as well as a financial one.
It's watchable, but
it is.
I think the best part about the film for me was Nate Parker.
Yes. I literally just picked up the page so that I could name drop him.
Yeah.
He's really good.
He is. He plays the kind of Richard Gere's. He owes Richard Gere one because he helped his father when his father was dying. Mm. But he's quite kind of rough guy. Trying to make ends meet. Yeah. But no, he's really good. But I don't like what they do with the trial, his trial, or his kind of hearing.
No. And they do go in like one area where Gere's trying to get the one thing done so that he might there then turn himself in. And that's the only time in the whole film where there's even a hint of like drawing it from like a moral, putting the moral angle on his perspective. But then, of course, as soon as he thinks that he might be able to get away with it, he just ditches that idea and tries to get everyone off. It's so unsatisfactory, the drama, because there is no resolution that ties things together, because you haven't gone down any of the roads properly.
Yeah,
and so it's more like you've just got to hope that he gets off. You've got to want him to get off.
Yeah,
and wiggle out of it. When how could you possibly want him to wiggle out of it?
It's just so half baked though, because it's like the the police seem to really want to get him, but it's not it's not as if the thing, like the event that happens itself, is that serious. I mean, it is serious, but it's not as if it's going to get police so impassioned. No. And he's not exactly a villain either. He's just kind of a rich guy. He's very nice to everybody, generally, but...
Yeah, I did like Susan Sarandon. She has the sort of the Winona Ryder Age of Innocence type scene towards the very end, and I thought she was very good in that particular scene. She doesn't have anything to do apart from that.
No. Do you like Britt Marling?
She was okay.
But I like the scene where they have that altercation on the park bench.
In the park, I was going to say. I prefer it, like when she's in that guy's office doing the print offs and then tries to fire him. I think that was probably her best scene for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't seen her be. There's a couple of things that people really like her in, and I haven't seen her in either of them. So this was my Michael Danner moment. Oh, that's what she looks like.
Yeah, it's just like, do we really need another film like this about rich people?
No, and it doesn't mine, because the thing about Margin Call and films like that was that, okay, and what was the other one? Too Big to Fail. Yeah, the TV one with William Hurt and Paul Giamatti. It's interesting because the interesting thing about it is them detailing the financial side of it, whereas that is not the case in this film at all.
Mm.
It's just like a backdrop. And it's more of a character piece, but then they don't go on the character route. So, it's...
Great.
4 out of 10, high 2 stars.
C+.
Yeah, it's a little bit below average for me. Okay. Right, so Broken City, which I was overjoyed to go and watch. Yeah, this is a thriller. Type film, starring Mark Wahlberg, who plays a private investigator who is a former New York cop who was charged but not actually brought to trial for the murder of somebody who had raped and killed someone or something like that, a girl, but then walked on a technicality, so he ended up shooting the guy. But didn't get brought to trial for lack of evidence. The mayor at the time was Russell Crowe, and just before Wahlberg got off at the beginning of the film, the commissioner Jeffrey Wright comes in saying, "I've got some evidence," and they decide to sit on it.
Mm-hmm.
So cut to 7 years later, he's now a private investigator, and Russell Crowe calls our man Wahlberg in to follow his wife around and take pictures of the, quote, son of a bitch who's sleeping with my wife. And it's all very fun.
Is he... Who plays the guy sleeping with his wife?
Ah, well, so he follows... So, famous person. So, he follows her around for a day and then spots her with Kyle Chandler. Kyle Chandler happens to be...
Night Lights?
Yes. Happens to be the... campaign manager for the bloke Barry Pepper running against Russell Crowe in the mayoral election, which is a few days away. So it's obviously it's like War and Peace basically in its plotting. And this is what annoys me about this film. Before, you know how when you go to the cinema beforehand, you have those from the red carpet type things with that lab with the blonde hair, and sometimes you'll have him do sit down interviews.
Yeah.
And there's a sit down interview one. Have you seen the one about Broken City with Wahlberg?
No.
Anyway, so Wahlberg sat there and he's talking about how it's like a throwback to the '70s, and it's one of these films where the best scenes aren't necessarily in the trailer. And right. So I thought, okay, fine. But they put the final big scene in this trailer for this film, so you know exactly what's happening.
What does he mean by '70s? Like all the president's men are kind of.
I don't know.
What's he?
I think it just means like a throwback where it's not all like special effects and it's about the plotting. It's about a private eye. It's about a bloke going around with a camera.
Okay.
I think that's what he means by it. And it's just completely not true because with this film, because they do put the final big scene with all the character motivations, which are kind of obvious anyway, because you know that Crowe's got dirt on him. from the very beginning. And it just really fails to convince with where they're going with it. Also, once he realizes that he's not really following Catherine Zeta-Jones to take pictures of a bloke who's sleeping with her, then he suddenly turns around, and even though he's just got paid 50 grand, he wants to take it up on his own and like try and like get his own back and uncover the truth and everything. Why would you care? Just walk away. He gives a crap. And it's not like Chinatown where he's got one lot paying him to do that. He keeps on adding on to it because he's that kind of... It's not like the sort of character thing where he's got, you know, okay, well, you pay me to find out this, and he goes to the other side, well, you pay me to find out this, and so he's working them both up against each other, and he's always upping the end result for him. But then, so then when you go in the personal do-the-right-thing areas, it's brilliant. No, not here. Zeta-Jones is actually quite soulful.
Right.
And quiet, which is nice because she usually isn't. But she's very underused. Crow's decent. Does what says in Jeffrey Wright's the same. Peppers, I'm not a fan in general. Wahlberg is just another one of these, him where he wants to portray himself as being a tough guy. It's quite cute actually that he keeps on doing this. But it's one of the Hughes brothers directed this, you know, the guys who did From Hell.
All right.
It's very smoothly put together.
Yeah.
And it's nice to look at. But it does drag a touch, and it's just things like this. The whole point is that going back to the bloke who he shot at the beginning, he's now together with that girl's sister. And then they have an argument halfway through. It's out of the blue, and then she dumps him, and then that's it. She's never in the film for the rest of the film. It's just completely dropped. So it's that kind of thing where, and some of the, we go on about screenplays not being dialogue, but some of the dialogue in this is just really shoddy, and borderline homophobic, borderline sexist, quite all the way through. But yeah, it's watchable. It's fine, but
how's Crow?
He's decent. He doesn't have a lot to do, but he's got such a command of screen presence that he's going to do well, particularly in that kind of role where you've got a man of inherent power.
Yeah.
It's just that there's no real nuance to anything. The nuance it tries to get is in the plotting, which is again just stunningly unconvincing. But it's okay. I mean, you come out of it and you think, well, it wasn't bad. Well, it wasn't that bad.
Is it sort of like surface level stuff, yeah, like not yeah. like Gangster Squad, not really believable?
Yeah, there is like a big the corporate corruption type side to it, underpinning everything. But even that, you don't really buy it when it's unveiled. It's if you give it your intellectual time, it doesn't hold up to that much scrutiny. But it's fine. It works with the nuts and bolts. But it's a little too neat. It just feels like they've wanted to work. That's what it feels like. It doesn't feel like this is a passion project for anyone involved.
No.
And it just feels like
this. That's why it's being released in
March. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just like one of these ones where I'm not doing anything at the moment. What script's most ready to go that people want me for? Yeah. It's that kind of film.
Yeah. Great.
Low 3 stars. It's average.
Okay. Alright, I elected to see Safe Haven, which is the latest film from Lasse Hallström, who seems to be getting less and less picky about which films he takes on.
Yeah.
And it starts with a young woman who's played by Julianne Hough running from something or someone in the dead of night. She soon arrives in a small West Coast town where she meets Josh Duhamel, who is a widower with 2 children, who runs a beach shack.
I was going to say, he must be in a workshop of some kind.
He runs a beach shack. The kids serve at the beach shack behind the counter. They develop a relationship, but inevitably the girl's past will come back to haunt her.
And that's the setup. Is this a haunting film?
It might not give me nightmares, but it's pretty bad. And the problem is, all the time, I'm waiting for this sordid past to kind of reveal itself.
The dark secret.
Yeah, and they have like little kind of cuts to where people searching for her and things like that. And when it gets to it, it's not very interesting.
Right.
Like,
didn't deserve the mystery.
No. It's all to do with Julianne Hough's husband.
Right.
And what has gone on there. And what they initially set it up to make it seem like she's killed him.
Right.
Because he's abusive. But then it kind of takes on a different path. But it's still kind of really trite.
Yeah.
And it's like the kind of films you see on TV. Like, just really kind of... It doesn't look like they had a budget. They did have a budget. Yeah. But it doesn't look like they did. And it's just such lowest common denominator levels of crime and romance.
Well, that's kind of him. He's quite formulaic in terms of his writing, but he thinks that he's like the second coming of Shakespeare. It's quite cute.
Well, what was The Notebook like? Was that not cloying and kind of...
The Notebook is unabashedly manipulative, but it works.
Right.
And it does have some very overdone things, but it's done earnestly enough that it gets around it.
But the thing about this is it isn't a tragedy.
Yeah.
It's just it's written as a thriller.
Oh, okay. So
with the romance on the side.
Oh.
But it just doesn't work. And I'm sorry, Julianne, but...
Does she deserve to be called Julianne? Can we just call her Huff?
Huff.
The Huffmeister.
Well, she might be Julianne Seacrest soon.
I didn't even want to bring that up. Inverted commas girlfriend.
She's just woefully inexpressive at times. To be fair to the girl, like, this role is not exactly one that requires a lot of panache, but like, she just hasn't got...
Does she sing?
No.
Oh.
Why?
Because she was in Rock of Ages. That's like her thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but did anybody really sing in that?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Really?
That was the point. They were all singing like rock songs.
So what were you going on about the soundtrack to this film? Because I didn't really notice it very much.
No, I just, when I was looking around Spotify, I came across a couple of people who I was just listening to like random albums of, and it turned out they had stuff on the soundtrack. So it's just more sort of like country, female country sort of, or indie folk type stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they like portray this place as if it's a paradise. I mean, all that's there is a bloody beach shack. And does this...
Does he fashion anything with his hands? Because that's like the usual Nicholas Sparks thing. You got to be sanding down something.
I think he's like a sit, like he has his boat or something.
Boats, yeah. Gosling was a rower in The Notebook.
But there's this little subplot involving a woman who, because Julianne Hough befriends her when she comes to the town, and it's like this woman's never left the town in her life, and then they have this argument in the middle. Where Julianne insults her because she's never left. Like, she doesn't know... She's not very worldly.
Yeah.
And then at the end, she takes off and goes to travel the world. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, there's very little to invest in the whole film.
Mm.
It's terrible. It's so bad.
How's Duhamel? Is he any good?
He's better than her, but he's not great either.
Mm.
It's paycheck stuff, like.
Yeah. And the thing is that they're not being cast for their dramatic chops, are they?
No. They're cast because they're young, white, and good-looking.
Yeah. Yeah. Tick, tick, tick.
D.
Yeah, first. I was going to say cross, cross, cross. V-O-V-O.
I'm holding off on the Fs this year. So, hence why I didn't see Hansel.
Right. For Famke. F for Famke. Right, so film of the week.
Yeah.
See, the thing is, it's not really... I mean, Stoker is really the film of the week.
It is for most people.
Yeah. But for any film geek, and I take it anyone who's listening to us is necessarily a film geek, we smell our own.
Although this one feels like it's the least anticipated of all his films.
It's because we haven't had to wait 6 years for it.
Yeah. Yeah, it played at Toronto, I think.
You heard Venezia.
Venezia. Did it play at Venice? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's been released. I think it's released in the US in May.
Yeah, I can't believe we got it first.
Yeah.
After
all that hoopla with the Tree of Life as well, like...
Yeah.
Production company and stuff.
Right, so I'll have a crack at this then. The plot of To the Wonder. Oh my God. Well, there isn't one. That's the rest. The Tree of Life. The Tree of Life. I was going to say, I keep wanting to put the Tree of Love. To the Wonder is about a couple of people played by Olga Kurylenko and Ben Affleck, who are together, they're in France, and he invites her to come and live with him in America, along with her young daughter.
Yeah.
And so the film is basically about them as they go over there, and the culture clash and the loneliness, etc., etc., and the toll it takes on the relationship, and then what happens when the visa runs out.
Yeah. And it's very clear. Their relationship comes across very clear to me.
Yeah, it
the dynamic of it.
It's really strange because there's virtually no. I say no when I'm over exaggerating, and but there is virtually no characterization in this, and there's virtually no detailing in the relationships in terms of specifics.
Yes.
Because what he does is, Malick notoriously cuts people out of his films. Adrian Brody played the lead character from the book, and he his virtual cameo in Thin Red Line. And it's as if he wants to cut Ben Affleck out of this film, and realizes that he can't. So it's as if I can't cut you out of the film, but I'm going to give you about 4 words to say. And so they're taking away, so you never know any specifics about what's really going on. And you never really, so you'll see them, but what he does is, he's trying to give you, through the sweeping romantic presentation of it all, he tries to get the emotion across that way, rather than through any sort of specifics of plotting or how they are together.
And I agree, it's more reliant on the actors as well with this than I think he ever has been before.
Well, what Malick does, particularly with his men, I mean, if you look at the men that he's cast in his films, they are male models. Every single last one of them. I mean, he's cast young Martin Sheen, Richard Gere, Colin Farrell.
Jim Caviezel.
Yeah, and Brad Pitt. And now he's cast Ben Affleck. I mean, these are just complete godly chiseled men.
Yeah,
and he usually doesn't cast. He usually casts interesting looking women, like your Sissy Spacex or your Brooke Adamses. So not your flat out sex bombs, but nice looking women who are interesting. And this time he's actually gone the Bond girl route. So it's really quite. He's just leaving nothing to chance in terms of the look. But yeah. I do think what he's done is by doing this, he's sort of going for something that's sort of to get under the skin and just be inherently universal. So when you see them arguing, they're making up, and it's all so stripped down.
Yeah.
And you've just got like the embraces and what have you. Everyone can relate to that. You don't need to know the specifics of what's going on.
Because it's a lot more personal than The Tree of Life, which was had grander themes and was sort of basically very humanist.
Yeah.
This is more like Days of Heaven,
yeah.
Especially with the rural setting, American setting.
And one thing with him, it's there's this one line which is just I actually laughed out loud, because it's very, if you were trying to lampoon Malick, you
is
would say
love?
Yeah, you would say something like, if you're trying to do one of his voiceovers and take the mic, you'd say something like, "What is this light that lights us? the darkness in the dark. That sort of thing is, yeah. is how you take the piss. And there is a line where she says in French, "What is this love that loves us?"
Yeah.
And yeah. you're I like, come on, Terry. Come on. I mean, please. But
going back to Affleck, I don't think that he is as concerned with the character's problems as he's concerned with Olga Kurylenko's character.
Mm.
And that kind of, like, the film suffers because of that, I think.
And it's very much...
It would be better if you got more of his troubles than hers.
Well, that's interesting because I actually looked at who was cut out of this film. Okay. Barry Pepper was supposed to be in this film.
Barry's back.
He was a priest, so I'm assuming that was for Javier Bardem's sort of subplot. Michael Sheen was playing Ben's boss.
Right.
So that's an area that they shoved down. Rachel Weisz was playing a friend of Ben's who was like talked to about the relationship and that sort of thing. So there's an area like his that you were just talking about then. And apparently Chastain just went to visit on set, and then suddenly they said, "Oh yeah, we'll pay for you." She's like, "Well, why are you paying? Oh, do you want to actually be in it?" And then she just realised that there's just no chance at all that they were going to be in that she was going to be in the film. So she just enjoyed like having a few scenes with Ben. So a lot of the stuff with Ben got cut out by the look of it. All these people who were just coming on set for a few days.
I think that's probably wise though, because like I think it would get too overwrought if the narrative was
both of them being miserable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think it's too long as it is. I think this should have been 90 minutes because it's a very compact story. And
I didn't mind it. I didn't mind the length. I wasn't really looking at my watch. My problem with the style of The Tree of Life was that it was too immediately apparent to me, and all the pans and all the editing out of it. And I was getting a little vibe of that to begin with, but it does kind of smooth out. And so by the time it smoothed out, I was sort of like getting into it, and so I wasn't looking at my, I hardly looked at my watch at all on this one, which I was quite pleased about. Did make me cry,
right?
At one point, but nothing. Again, no, there's no specifics. It was just a fluke. It was just that I learnt to play a particular piece of music for a woman years ago, and he rather delightfully decided to put that over the wedding scenes. So cheers, mate. Yeah, cheers, mate. that was fun. Didn't expect that. Because it's a Shostakovich, the second movement of Shostakovich Piano Concerto. So it's a famous piece in terms of like music snobs, but it's not a famous piece like Moonlight Sonata.
Yeah,
that like the average person would at least recognise, if not be able to name. It's not. So I do think this, but in general, I think that the feelings, it does communicate feelings well.
Yes.
Within the relationship, but it's done purely visually rather than anything else.
I think that works well for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost as if, like you said, he didn't really trust Affleck.
No.
Fully.
Well, this is the thing, because Olga's very good in this.
Yeah.
And the level of charm is absurd when she's like dancing around, or it's just, you can, he just must be helpless.
Yeah.
With the seduction, because it's just a joke.
She's very like childish and playful, but it's almost as if it's too good to be true, and he realizes that eventually.
Yeah,
I mean, who'd be plagued with having to choose between Olga Kurylenko and Rachel McAdams? I mean, come on.
Well, no, and this is like, one thing I want to talk about. It's in terms. I mean, the narrative that was another of my big problems with The Tree of Life, and it weakens it here because Rachel McAdams is in this for about 5 minutes. And it's when Olga's gone because her visa's... It's in the period when Olga's gone because her visa has expired and when she comes back. And so you see her with Affleck, and it's fine. And then there's this brilliant section of interconnected scenes, which is basically when he's dumped her. And it's her voiceover saying, "You turned it into nothing." And the visuals are absolutely brilliant. It's all very gothic, and you can sense like... the woman scorn fury of it all. And then after the fact you cut into something else and you see why she was that pissed off, and you're thinking, well, okay, fine, now I understand, because you've just skated over all that while I was watching it, and now you put it in after the fact and told me. If I'd have known that while I was watching it, it would have been even better. So so the fractured narrative and the jumping, skating over it, sort of distills it down and actually makes it less dramatic than it actually could have been.
But I think if it was more dramatic, then I think it would get overwrought, like repetitive with the relationship.
Mm. But then it's like stuff towards the end where you'll suddenly hear him say something. You're like, what? Oh, they're going there? And then it will carry on for like another 10 minutes and you'll think something else. And just from how you've seen them together, you think things are smoothing out. And then bang. No, so I think it's very lurching in the narrative. And I do think this is quite a good film.
Yeah.
Because I do think its strengths are really, 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 really strong. And with Olga and the inherent romanticness of it all, it does work. But if they'd have smoothed out the narrative problems and injected at least some investment in terms of character and what have you, this could be brilliant.
Well, this is why I was saying that it's more reliant on her.
Yeah.
I think she gives like the most independent performance I've seen in a Malick film. As the character, and I think he realised that and he chose to roll with that at the expense of Ben. But it's just so well made as a visual storytelling feat.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the Bardem thing? Because I don't think that worked.
No, I think it kind of works for the underpinning in general in terms of what his character represents in terms of like crisis of faith and what have you, or the battle between living as a human being and having the absence of God, the absence of God and what have you. I think that kind of works in underpinning where she is in that relationship. It's all very wishy-washy in terms of how it's tied together. So it relies on a lot of goodwill.
Yeah.
In order to, you just wonder why. There's a scene of infidelity, which just comes completely out of the blue, and on the one hand, you could say, well, it does come out of the blue if you're the other person, so you don't need to necessarily backstory it, what have you, because it's about what happens to this couple, and so if he's part of the couple or she's part of the couple, then you don't need to really go there, but. It feels jarring when these things happen, rather than being a natural. You haven't got the character underpinning to explain it.
Is this with the guy who drives the truck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and it is literally a case of as soon as she goes, he's shacked up with McAdams, and so when you haven't gone into the detailing, that's when it becomes problematic. I mean, and it's not problematic to the point that it derails the film, or it just prevents you from being fully immersed and invested with the characters, because you don't really know them and you don't really know why they're doing what they're doing.
It might be a situation where a rewatch would kind of illuminate more things to do with their relationship, because it felt pretty natural and clear to me, like the dynamic of it anyway, rather than the...
That's the thing, you get the essence of it. You get the centre of it emotionally rather than intellectually, and that's why I think it's inherently appealing to me. But
I think it appeals to you because it's about love and it's more personal, and it still is personal with all of the scope of the visuals and shots of Paris and shots of wherever they are, Texas or wherever they are in America.
I think it's Oklahoma. I read that it's not in the film. I read that somewhere, but but it's adding to the general good start to 2013, for me.
Yeah,
I mean that's a very good performance to have that this early in the year, and it's going to be right at the top of some of the technical categories as well. It's not going anywhere. it's like the Grandmaster. Some of that stuff's just staying.
I think I don't think this will be an awards player, though.
No,
I think this is getting consigned to one of his lesser works, even though it's very good.
Mm.
Great.
Low 4 stars.
B. Okay, so we're going to talk about films that made us cry, right?
Yeah, in general. well, more hopefully more specifically, where the actual films made you cry.
The scenes, the specific scenes.
Well, no. I'd say the film, but having made you cry because you were being invested in the story rather than because you're just a wuss.
Oh, right. Like the bucket list.
Yeah, shall I go first then?
Go for it.
Okay, because I might have mentioned this on the podcast in passing, but I haven't pimped it quite strongly enough. The first one I'll go with is a Zhang Yimou film called The Road Home, which is from like 1999, and it's about a guy who's died, and his grandson has to perform a ritual where you walk the body back from the mortuary to be buried. And so it cuts between the modern day storyline of him doing the ritual, walking it back, which is in black and white, with the story of how his grandparents met, which is in colour, and Zhang Ziyi plays the grandmother when she's younger. And it's just the most beautiful story. And so once you've got some of the backstory with how they met, and you actually get into them walking the grandfather's body back, I was just in pieces for at least half an hour of that film. It's just beautiful. I mean, the cinematography in that film is outrageous. It's just, but it is just a sweet. It's a U. It's not even a PG. It's a U.
When's that from? Is that
99? IMDb says 2000, but it's actually 99. And it is just a gorgeous, gorgeous film, and my favourite Zhang Yimou film, which is saying something.
Good. Mm. I'm going to start with one that might be surprising.
Okay.
I always cry at Erin Brockovich.
Right.
And it's not, I don't think it's a particularly manipulative thing, more than the fact that the film does so well at really putting these people at the centre of it and the issue itself, and really making you want her to overcome the people poisoning the water supply, etc., etc. And there's this tiny moment at the end where she goes to this woman's house and she brings her boyfriend, a biker, Aaron Eckhart.
It's random. Random.
Never looked worse.
No.
To the woman's house, one of the people who's going to get compensated, and tells her. And it's just really well acted, and I always cry at that bit when she kind of breaks a speech and she can't say anything. She just... And I just think it's great.
Right, yes. I'm looking through old ones. I do have a second one, but I'm just skipping through looking for a third specifically. Fai Lan, which is a Choi Min-sik film. He's speaking, going back to Park Chan-wook. he was the guy in Old Boy. And this is just should be prime for a remake. This is about the first 30 minutes of this film are horrible. He's a gangster, and he's a completely pathetic bloke, and it's all like swearing and violence and him just being generally a loser. He sells porn tapes to 15-year-olds and goes to prison for it. He's just a horrible character. And if you can get past that first 30, 35 minutes, it turns out that he married a girl, Cecilia Chung, so that she could stay in the country. And it turns out that she's died and he has to go and identify the body. And so what then turns out is, through a couple of like letters and what have you, is a love story between two people who've never met. And when he reads the second letter, he's just on... It's just staggeringly moving, and every single time. I mean, there's probably about three or four different moments in this film, one of which gets me purely on a personal level, nothing to do with the story, where she goes and buys toothbrushes because she thinks he's coming. I always cry at that bit, and that's nothing to do with the story. But aside from that, it gets you within the story as well, and it's just that Fai Lan is just brilliant. It is online. And if it was going to be remade, you'd have something like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Is it an old film?
2001. It's my best picture of 2001.
Wow.
So that's over. Like I think I really like Gosford Park that year. That would be my choice otherwise. But yeah, that is. I mean, that you can get something that moving between two characters who never actually met, or maybe you get it that moving because they never met. It's great.
Cool. Sounds like a Nicholas Sparks novel, actually.
It's the this thing the Korean, the South Koreans do genre better than anyone else.
Okay, my second one is Dancer in the Dark.
Right.
Which, there is a moment, and it's always the same time when I cry. And I cry for the last 15 minutes.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Everything from My Favourite Things, where she sings that in her yes. cell.
Yeah.
And with the sounds from the air vent. And and when she doesn't hear the sound, she starts crying because she needs some kind of diegetic kind of...
to get her imagination going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just makes me bawl every time. And that woman as well, expertly played. I don't know who the actress is. I've totally forgotten, but she's great.
Oh, no, the one in the prison. Yeah. I know who you mean, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I could just mention, like, 2046 here and just be really boring, but I'm not going to. we've pimped Ron Carby enough. One that I might go for, just off the top of my head, is something like The World of Apu, which is the final film in, just more to pimp the trilogy, final film in Sir Judge Ray's Apu trilogy. And so everyone loves the first one. The first one's got the monster reputation, Patha Panchali, but I'm not that big a fan because there's some really obvious flaws in it. Because literally in terms of like the technique, because they were learning on the job, they'd never done anything, cinematographer had never shot before, he'd never directed before, the actor had never acted before. But by the time they get to the second one of Parajito, that's all smoothed out. He's got brilliant style in The World of Apu, and it's all like it's been criticised as being like misery porn, and so you've followed this lad who's like never really had anything, and in the third film. He's there on his own. Everybody's died. All his family's died. He's on his own. And he gets invited to a wedding. And at the wedding, the groom's done one. And so this family's going to be shamed. So he ends up marrying the girl. Getting talked into marrying the girl to, like, to save her honour and all that sort of stuff. And so then, of course, he takes her back to his naff little apartment with her. And then, of course, he falls in love with her. Then, of course... she dies as well. But by that point, once you've seen the three films and you've got to that point, it would be moving anyway. But once you've got it in context and you know all these things that have happened to this, and like he lives by the railway, which reminds him of his family when he's growing up. So literally every time you have a train, you're thinking of like your sister. And so by that point in it, you're just like, oh my God. Every time, guaranteed.
I want to see that trilogy, actually. I almost watched Patha Panchali the other day. But...
yeah, I would say Patha Panchali might put you off visually. Some people love it, though, just because it's so stripped down. But I think Parajito is probably the best film of the three.
Right.
The second one.
Okay. My last one is The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Ah.
Which I like. I think I attribute this to all the close-ups, but...
yeah. There's a few.
Yeah. But it's... I do think she's very expressive. And the situation... the film kind of is quite clear in demonising the people who are subject... the English, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It is the English, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
So it's very clearly the bad guys versus her. And she's angelic and she's wonderful, but... I just think she's very kind of moving.
Oh, yeah.
In a strange way. Not in a conventional way either, just...
well, no, I think any time you see somebody, you see anyone in that level of distress...
yeah.
It's going to get you, on some level. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of the film, but it's arresting.
Yeah, it's committed to. It's good. Okay. Shag, marry, kill?
Yes. So I've got four. So the one that I would shag, so watch again right now, would be Broken City.
The one that I would watch again now is Stoker.
Right. I would marry To the Wonder. Easily.
Yes, me too. Easily.
I don't think I'd even mind watching that every weekend for the rest of my life.
Film of the week, people.
Yeah, not sarcastically. Actually, film of the week. And it's on about 35-ish cinemas, so it might be like probably about a half an hour drive for most people in a decent sized city.
But totally worth it.
Yeah, it is worth it, yeah. So kill, destroy all the cinematic negatives, stoke it.
I would kill Safe Haven.
Yeah, yeah.
Although Arbitrage doesn't have any business existing either.
No, it's got nothing really going for it, apart from to get the Golden Globes to get an excuse to get Richard Gere on the red carpet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so Watson Factor.
Olga. Well,
obviously. By all sane measures, given the wardrobe in that and hair in that film, we should be say do clausing Olga, but you just can't. It's just impossible because she's just absolutely stunning.
What about Rachel?
Very nice, but I'll stick with a 2. Okay. I think. Yes.
Not Susan, no.
Susie, well, she was the best in her film. wouldn't say no.
Okay, Pupod, we have...
Duhamel?
No.
Ben?
No.
Not enough facial hair for you. good?
No.
Oh, didn't think you'd go for good.
Okay. Alden Ehrenreich is in that, but yeah. His character...
No, that's the thing, character. Because yeah. In Beautiful Creatures, it's the character that pushes him over the edge. Whereas in this,
What they do with the character.
Oh, God.
He's the same, though. He's really charming, and then they suddenly change the character.
Yeah.
Don't like it.
Yeah. Gear, I take it, no.
No.
The silver-haired foxness isn't working.
And
there's Letitia Caster in Arbitrage. No,
who?
I'll stay with... she's a former lingerie model in the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. His girlfriend.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
pretty.
I'll stick with 2. I'll be nice.
Okay. I'm going with 1.0.
Super.
Excellent.
Super. Right, so...
we have a blog.
We do.
It's moviepodcast.com. You can see all our grades for everything we've ever done on the podcast on there, and awards... Which yep. are continually updated every week whenever yep. we see something different.
Yeah, but it seems, well, but at least by me, I think this might be the first time I've not. Since we've also got a lot more descriptions of the segments, which I think if you read them, you will see how unseriously we take them.
Yeah, these are kind of ingest.
The Hathaway Protocol description is just.
We have some interesting images on there as well.
The necessary offshoots. Anyway, yeah, so that's fun. Click on the segments thing. That's fun.
We're on Facebook and iTunes too.
Yeah, Twitter.
And submit any questions that you might have about anything from the past, present,
or a suggestion for whatever we end up calling it, be it like retro for our retro section. Any suggestions on something we might want to watch that we might not have seen?
Yeah.
Carte blanche. Right. You can do basically whatever you want. You can get us to do a segment. People have done it.
next week?
Yeah. Well, stacked at the Cineworld. Oz the Great and Powerful. Thank you, Mila. I know that film exists now.
It might be my turn to do the Joe Wright rant next week.
Really?
If they destroy the sanctity of The Wizard of Oz.
The pureness of the claws.
We have Side Effects, yeah?
Side Effects, Parker, The Guilt Trip, and Robot and Frank, people. It's at Cineworld.
Do I have to see it?
Well, no, you don't have to see it. I mean, you'll be a complete cultureless savage if you don't. But you don't have to. Robot and Frank's my runner-up for 2012. So does that mean it's my best actual fictional narrative film of 2012? Probably by definition, yes.
Well, yeah. There's not much...
Because Samsara isn't a story.
That's true. So is it a screenplay winner then?
Yeah. It's really fun. Really fun. Not very serious, but very fun. Crowd pleaser. Yes. So yeah, there's like 5 new films out at the multiplex next week. So,
including My Boy Jason.
Yeah, and Lopez stripping off even in the trailer. I bet that's the only time she does it in the film, and they've just slapped it in the trailer.
Maybe she doesn't do it in the film.
Like, yeah. What was it the other Die week? Hard and Die Hard. Why it's subversive. No, I think that's... I think there'd be riots if that doesn't happen from the teenage boys. Yes, so that's it. What's your jam at the moment, musically? Got anything going on?
Well, generally, stuff I like.
Yeah? Or what's the particular song you're listening to at the moment?
Oh, I listen to the new Alice Russell album, which is very good. She's kind of... I don't know what you'd class her as, kind of alt jazz, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. Possibly.
Tegan and Sarah, great pop album, Heartthrob.
Yeah. I Shoot Horses, Winter Beats, that's my jam at the moment.
Cool. Is that to get us to play it?
No. That I just I was going to slap that in the beginning and I forgot. It's the first time I've ever been organised properly for the podcast, like researching what we actually, who actually Terry Malick cut from the film.
Is there like 5 pages?
Yeah, it's a full. The whole thing for the podcast is like a full A4 piece of paper. It's because I'm the least organised person in the world. It's just wrong.
Yeah, well, I normally like write notes for everything, but being hungover.
Oh,
I,
sound mixing! The sound mixing into The Wonder was horrendous.
Why?
Music was too loud. Voiceovers were too quiet. You could barely hear what was going on at some points. That's the
Ben,
one.
I couldn't hear Ben.
No, exactly. It's just bad. It's like Michael Mann mixed this movie. Just because I think I said too many nice things about it earlier. And I was saying I would watch it every weekend for the rest of my life. I wouldn't be able to listen to it every weekend for the rest of my life, even though the soundtrack's really good.
You could actually watch it on mute. It wouldn't be that bad.
Put it on with subtitles so I can hear what the man's saying.